Cochran, you're first.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Winston Cochran on behalf of John Hong. Let me quickly say something that affects all three defendants concerning the science in this case. It's very simple. Take one peanut, crush it up. Take 10 walnuts, crush it up, dump them all together. If you find one little fragment of a peanut, that doesn't mean all 11 nuts were peanuts. That's the fallacy in the government science. That's why we needed a Daubert hearing. That's why I needed to talk to Agent Love from the DEA lab, not just Winooski from the DEA lab, because that was exactly what happened with the pills found at the apartment on June 2nd. If there are any questions about that, about the fallacy in the science, if not, let me move on to the, first of all, the first and second points of error. The government wants to give me the burden of proof concerning the harm on the continuance. Let's look at their cases. Hickerson, no subpoena issued was the rationale of the case. I can't get a subpoena issued to the nation of India for Rick Singh. And in that case, they said...
Counsel, don't make a speech. What do you do if the worst baddie in an enormous operation like this is somewhere in India? Do you get to continue the case forever? How many continuances did you already get?
Okay. This was the fifth one, and I would have sympathy with that argument, but for one strange little thing, 6 weeks after we filed our brief, lo and behold, Rick Singh is back in the United States. When the U.S. government wanted to get him back in a hurry, they did. You can check that out on PACER. It's after the record excerpts were filed in this case, but you can take judicial notice of PACER. January 22nd, he's back in the U.S. District Court. He's set for trial in August.
Did he waive his Fifth Amendment rights?
I'm sorry?
Has he waived his Fifth Amendment rights?
No, but it, but
would
for...
He, would, so where's your evidence that he would have testified in your case?
Okay. I don't know for a fact, but you can't put that burden on me pre-trial because you can never tell what a co-defendant is going to do.
Who goes first when they're all asserting their Fifth Amendment rights? Who goes first?
Well, obviously, his Fifth Amendment rights are going to prevail. However, a lot of people pled out in this case. The majority of people pled out. For all I know, Rick Singh could have said, I'm going to plead out just like my brother Amrik Singh did and get a sweet deal, and therefore, I'm going to exonerate these three little fish over here, the three people who happened to go to trial. And so it's entirely possible. But you can't expect me to guarantee you something in advance when I can't even get the man in the United States. The government had that power. In fact, they proved they could do it because they did it. They also, the government's brief says nothing at all about the sentencing, the point two in this. And by the way, point two applies to all three defendants, although Gins and Tin may have said we oppose the continuance on the trial itself. Judge Harmon let everybody share motions after that in the trial, so I would contend that all three defendants enjoy the benefit of my point two, which is to say you at least could put off the sentencing until after Rick Singh. And the government's brief says nothing at all about point two in that respect. They don't even address it. I would suggest, too, that Rick Singh, we know, could have done several things. He knew the roles of the various people better than anybody. He would know better than anybody what a liar Chavez was. Now, we proved it a little bit with the bogus Amrik Singh signature in the so-called ledger, but Rick Singh would know a lot more about that. Rick Singh would know better than anybody else whether there was one conspiracy or multiple conspiracies. The government's brief says John's participation in the conspiracy was overwhelming. That's exactly the problem. Rick Singh could shed light on that. It's not just the conspiracy.
How would you have harm if there was overwhelming evidence?
I'm sorry?
How would you have harm even if there were multiple conspiracies?
Okay,
if your client was clearly guilty of one of the conspiracies.
Okay, and as we pointed out, that rule, Peña Rodriguez says that so-called Faulkner rule from Faulkner, is not absolute. And that aspect of Peña Rodriguez is never even addressed in the government's brief. So you're not absolutely locked in to Faulkner. And this is a case where very clearly the spillover guilt from other people affected it. Look at the jury note. We can't ask jurors after the fact what affected your thinking. But if you get a jury note, you can get an insight, and the jury note concerned LSD. None of these three defendants, there's no evidence that they had even any knowledge that Skidovich was making bunkies using LSD. And yet LSD, which rightfully scares a lot of people, was foremost in the minds of the jury. You know that because they sent out a note specifically talking about LSD.
So that LSD with relation to these defendants?
Yes, because these were the only three on trial, and their jury sent out a note wanting to know about the LSD.
I was concerned about that. I don't know where the harm comes in, but I don't know why Pinkerton is involved in the instructions on your clients. Were these instructions with respect to Pinkerton kind of general instructions that applied to everybody, or did they relate to just to your clients?
No, but we had the common set of instructions, but then we could not get some of the requested instructions, which would cure some of the problems.
The Pinkerton instruction didn't just go to y'all. It went to all the defendants, some of whom were charged with substantive offense.
And we've got the problem of somebody else's.
That answers my question. Yes or no?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Your time is up.
Okay.
Jesus. Next. Mr. Kuniansky.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Richard Kuniansky on behalf of Appellate Jens. I'm going to discuss two issues with the Court this morning. One is the limitation of cross-examination, and the other one is a lack of Daubert hearing. On the cross-examination, probably one of the most single important questions you could ask a witness who's testifying is whether or not he struck a deal with the government that called for the dismissal of counts that involved a minimum mandatory sentence. And the cross-examination was restricted on that, and counsel was not allowed to ask what was probably the single most telling question that he could ask Mr. Yonker. And I don't know a reason why that was not allowed. Now, I understand that cross-examination is not limitless, but on the other hand, I would contend that it's an abuse of discretion when there's a key witness testifying against your client and you're not allowed to explore the fact that he cut a deal with the government that did away with the minimum mandatory sentence. So then the next question is, if that was a denial of a Sixth Amendment right to confrontation, the Court is then going to look at whether or not that error was harmless. And I would cite the Jimenez case that I cited in my brief. And the Court has a several-part test of looking to determine whether or not the error was harmless. And the Court doesn't look at the specific testimony. The Court looks at the specific testimony admitted, not just whether or not there was enough evidence to convict. So the Court doesn't just examine the record and say, okay, let's take away this witness. Was there enough evidence to convict? If there was, that was harmless error. Instead, the Court, under a Chapman harmless error analysis, looks at several items. One of them, the importance of the witness's testimony in the prosecution case. Yonkers was probably the single most important witness against Jens. He testified regarding some bad cocaine deal in which Jens was supposedly trying to get rid of some cocaine on behalf of Rick Singh. He testified about a meeting at Minda Harris's apartment where Jens was supposedly acting as an enforcer, and he also testified on an occasion where Jens distributed some drugs to him. Also looked to whether the testimony was cumulative. I submit that testimony was not cumulative. Whether or not the overall strength of the prosecution's case, and I'd like to point out something in that regard. There were several witnesses, approximately six, that placed Jens involved in dealing drugs. Cross-examination was restricted on two of those. Now, there was not a single gram of any type of drug found on Jens in a search of his home, nothing. The entire case against him was based on the testimony of so-called snitch witnesses. So I would contend that when you have that type of situation where the entire case is based on the testimony of accomplices and you have no physical evidence against him, that the denial of the Sixth Amendment right to confront the witnesses is not harmless error. There was also a situation where Minda Harris, another witness against him, testified, and counsel was not permitted to explore whether Minda Harris had made a deal with some other defendants that in return for money she would testify favorably to them. Now, I enjoy the government's response to this. Basically, what the government says in their brief is this would cause confusion of issues to allow this to go before the jury. Do we actually think that our juries are such nitwits that they can't figure out that if somebody is testifying under a deal where they're avoiding a minimum mandatory sentence, that that might affect their credibility? And likewise, if a witness has gone out and solicited to perjure her testimony in return for money, that, gee, maybe we want to weigh that witness's testimony a little more carefully. So I would contend that based on the denial of confrontation with these two witnesses, that the conviction against Mr. Jin should be reversed. The second issue I was going to address was Daubert. Mr. Cochran has briefly addressed that. I don't think there's any question but from the record what the court did in this situation. The court made a comment along the lines of it would just be silly to handle such a hearing. We're just going to put it all in front of the jury and let the jury sort it out. I would submit to the court that that's not the proper way to do the gatekeeping function. Now, I don't have any problem that the testimony of a chemist is probably so established that a chemist is going to be able to testify without requiring a Daubert hearing. But I don't think it's quite as clear with the sampling technique that's employed and whether or not it's statistically correct. And I'm not aware of any case that has taken judicial notice that that sampling technique is correct. Essentially what the court said is, well, gee, that's according to DEA protocol. They use their sampling technique. I'm going to go ahead and let it in. I don't know how this court looks at it because there's no record to evaluate it. There's really nothing before the court. There's simply a defense objection that we don't think that this sampling technique is scientifically proven and a court statement that I think a hearing would be silly. Now, I've only been able to find one case involving this issue. It is an unpublished case, and in that case, the court did say that they were not going to require a Daubert hearing in that situation. But I would respectfully submit that a Daubert hearing should be required. Unless there are any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wynn.
May it please the court. My name is Reagan Wynn. I'm here on behalf of Tin Hong. I would like to address my comments this morning to two of the jury charge issues. The first one is the one that Judge Benavidez asked about, the Pinkerton instruction, and the other one is the denial of the requested common objective instruction. My research skills may not be as good as those of the clerks and your honors, but I have been unable to find a single case anywhere where a Pinkerton instruction was given.
Where somebody wasn't charged with a substantive offense.
Where there were no substantive counts.
How did this happen? Did you all objected to it and the government insisted on the Pinkerton instruction? How did it, I mean, I can't imagine if it was pointed out why you would give that instruction to somebody that wasn't charged with a substantive offense and charge the jury that they could find him guilty of substance offenses that they weren't even charged with.
Your Honor, I think if you read the record as a whole, right, wrong, or indifferent, I think that the district judge was somewhat annoyed with the way the defense had conducted their case.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was some sort of what I would consider open hostility between.
Yeah, but regardless, I guess that either happens or is perceived to happen by defense lawyers. When I was there, I perceived it to happen sometimes. I guess is what I'm saying. Did you all say to the judge, well, wait a minute. You're telling the jury they can find him guilty of substantive offenses. He's not even charged with a substantive offense. And was it brought to her attention?
Yes, Your Honor. At pages 3720 to page 3721, the defense objected. And they said the objection, and this may not have been the most artfully worded objection, but here's what it was. However, since this jury is only getting to decide the conspiracy count, this would suggest that they could be held responsible under a conspiracy count for something that's actually a lesser offense than another person pled to. And so, in effect, they're being convicted for the greater on vicarious liability for what's actually a lesser. But
it tells them that they can be convicted for a substantive offense when they're not charged with a substantive offense. That goes to what I was trying to figure out. How this colloquy, did the government then say, no, we want that instruction in there?
No, Your Honor. The trial judge, the district court just said overruled.
Yeah, the government just got out of the way.
Yes, Your Honor.
I see. All right.
The other thing I think it's important to look at in the charge is there's the standard instruction. You have no right to disregard any one instruction. And I think a jury, when faced with this Pinkerton instruction, it's hopelessly confusing. They go back there, they read the instructions, they say, okay, we're going to try and figure out if he's guilty of a conspiracy or not, and then they get to the Pinkerton instruction, and they say, now what do we do with this? We can't disregard it, and it talks about this other theory of liability, but what do we do with it?
How do you get over the harm question? I mean, if they can't be convicted of a substantive offense, and that would allow them to convict him of a substantive offense, but they couldn't, how did you get harmed, I guess? What's your argument there, that the jury may have thought that they've committed other offenses that they weren't charged with?
I think that the harm is this. The jury, if they conclude that he has some sort of liability under Pinkerton, the only way that they can give voice to that belief is to sign the only guilty verdict presented to them, and that's the guilty verdict to the conspiracy in count one. And that is our harm. When you put that Pinkerton instruction in there, it so hopelessly confuses things that the jury, if they want to follow that instruction and find somebody guilty under that, the only way they can give voice to it is to find them guilty of the conspiracy. And with regard to my particular client, Tin Hong, I don't think there's going to be any dispute. The evidence, there was the least amount of evidence against him of any of the defendants. And the jury, if you read the notes, you know, they sent out a note about an hour before the verdict came back, and you can tell they were looking at my client and trying to figure out what the evidence was against him, and they particularly asked for the limited evidence that was presented against him and were told that they hadn't asked the right way and didn't get it. I think in that situation, we have shown the harm. They are clearly trying to decide if he's guilty, and when you get to that Pinkerton instruction, it so hopelessly confuses them that we have shown harm. With my remaining 15 seconds, I would point out that in our issue three, we requested a common objective charge, which is a substantively correct statement of law. It is not otherwise covered in these instructions. And in a case where there were these defendants literally all over the world with all kinds of different drugs, all kinds of different offenses, it was harm not to give that instruction.
Thank you. Turner.
May it please the court, Jim Turner. Let me come to the first issue. I think I have to broach is why Pinkerton? Because in all honesty, I don't know why there was a Pinkerton instruction in the middle of this instruction either. Looking at the record, what we have at the pre-charge conference, it was almost as if the parties were speaking in tongues at this instance. The government never had an opportunity to move to withdrawal the Pinkerton instruction because the judge did gavel them down. The argument advanced by the defendants was this instruction is confusing because it suggests guilt of conspiracy based upon charges that they're not charged with on the substantive counts. I would suggest that if we follow the rule that juries are presumed to follow their instructions, in this instance, they would follow the instructions as a whole. Before they could be found guilty of conspiracy, they had to find that they were parties to the agreement.
Was this kind of the charge was kind of repeated as to all the defendants that were tried in this case, including some that were charged with substantive offenses?
Well, it was one. The charge in this instance is just these defendants. None of the other defendants are named. In fact, I'll look at the indictment as a whole.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how it happened. Like, if there was a whole lot of other defendants being tried, and you just kind of mimicked the charges on Pinkerton on everybody and not realize that.
I can only suspect, Your Honor, that that's precisely what it was had, that the computer and the word processor is a wonderful thing, but occasionally they leave things in there that
shouldn't have been. What do you do with Tin's argument that, as to him, that the evidence was much less and not overwhelming, and therefore it may have. How would you describe the evidence?
Well, I think the evidence against him is actually compelling, because on the July 11th, 2002 incident, he was very much a party to this delivery in the controlled buy situation. So there was eyewitness that he was involved in this aspect of the conspiracy. Moreover, his brother attested to the fact that he had bad health and he needed assistance, and
well,
he got it from
him. Some of it was that his car was registered to John or these other people. But other than his car, what do you have him doing? What do you have Tin? What's the testimony on Tin's involvement in the conspiracy?
As I recall, I think he was actually the party that was delivering the to the dough.
And did he also get sent out to get money or?
I think that was predominantly, that was John Wong, in all honesty, Your Honor. I believe it was John Hung that was the one that was delivering cash and envelopes with respect to Tin. Briefly on this issue of the continuance and the absence.
Who was it that testified that Tin delivered the drugs?
I believe it was the DE agent. I think it was Ferdinand Large, if I'm not mistaken. With respect to the continuance, Rick Singh, it is true, looking at Pacer, he is back in the country. He came back in January. He was finally extradited in January. First, matter of note, the United States Attorney's Office doesn't control extradition procedures with India. Moreover, I would suspect the State Department has more pressing issues than extraditing Rick Singh, although they did their absolute best at getting back. With respect to the would he be willing to testify on behalf of Mr. Wong, Mr. Gins, and Mr. Wong, I would suggest he wouldn't have run to India if he had been inclined to testify. Moreover, he has since been arraigned, and his trial is set for August, so he shows no inclination at this point in time of pleading. So I don't think he's going to reduce or offer exculpatory evidence in that respect. The Dolbert issue, briefly. The cases, I have three new cases at the site, and the one that Mr. Kiniansky referred to is United States versus Fung, almost on all fours, save for one telling point. There, the defendants actually hired their own expert to challenge the statistical analysis. Here, there's no evidence that that was done.
Is that on the sampling that you're talking
yes,
about?
Yes, it is, and it's almost on all fours. It's unpublished. Additionally, we would note that in United States versus Beasley, the Fourth Circuit upheld a no Dolbert hearing on the making of crack cocaine. That case is cited in the briefs. It's at 495 Fed 3rd, 142. And finally, in United States versus Williams, which is analogous to this, you have a murder case, a ballistics expert. All the ballistics testing is sound. The expert's qualifications are sound, as they were in this instance. And there were, it was held, it was not an abuse of discretion not to have a Dolbert hearing in that instance. If there are no other additional questions, I'll rest upon the brief.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Wynn, I think you reserved some time.
I did. Briefly, just to clarify for the court, we were the only three defendants in this particular jury trial. Mm-hmm. Everybody else had either pled or was not in the country. So it is incredibly, there is no good reason for the Pinkerton instruction to be in the charge, other than it must have come out of some other charge or just gotten thrown in with the rest of the pattern instructions.
Did you get a chance to make your objection and point it out to the court what was wrong with it, or did you just get, I'm trying to.
And Your Honor, I wasn't in the trial, so from reading the record, they had a charge conference, and I believe Mr. Cochran handled all the objections, and he made the objection that I read to the court a little while ago. It was just overruled with one word, and they went on to the next one. And if you read the way the charge conference went, all the objections were overruled in that manner. With regard to Tin Hong's involvement in the case, I think the most telling thing is this. If you read the government's brief, they say, well, the phone records really show you how this conspiracy was all put together. The testimony is clear. There is not a single phone call to or from Tin Hong in any of the wiretaps phone records. Additionally, he's not listed in any of the drug ledgers. They see him run around. At best, the government proved he was an errand boy for his brother. The last thing I'd like to say is with regard to the Daubert issue. If you look at the words the trial judge used, it is clear that she abdicated her position as the gatekeeper. And I would say to the court, the real problem with doing that is it deprives us of any meaningful appellate review of the issue. It's one thing to say, you know, I'm going to take judicial notice that this has been heard a lot of other places, and there's all these other, I've been presented with a transcript from another trial in this sampling thing. I've read the transcript, and it's okay, so we're not going to have another hearing. It's another thing entirely to just say this is silly, and I'm not going to do it.
Have the argument. Thank you, counsel. Okay.